Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of the Eastern Arc podcast series. My name's Phil Ward and I'm director of Eastern Arc. And today we're going to look at health and well-being during lockdown. Felicia Huppert of Cambridge described well-being as the combination of feeling good and functioning effectively. However, lockdown and the underlying pandemic has put a strain on both of these. Isolation, inactivity, boredom, uncertainty and powerlessness, as well as anxiety and exhaustion from balancing work and additional pressures at home, are having an impact on our mental and physical health. With me to talk about these issues is Professor Anne-Marie Minahane of UEA. She's Professor of Nutrigenomics at Norwich Medical School, and she looks at the impact of select dietary components, in particular N3 fatty acids, on cardiometabolic and cognitive health, and is involved in a project based at UEA tracking health in lockdown. Dr. Valerie Gladwell of Essex is a senior lecturer in the School of Sport, Rehabilitation and Exercise Sciences. Her research interests include physical activity for health and well-being, with a particular interest in workplace well-being and changing behaviour. Dr. Glenn Davison is a reader in the School of Sport and Exercise Sciences at the University of Kent. His interests include the effect of nutrition on human immune function, physiological adaptation, and the effects of supplements on our health and performance. I wanted to start by thinking what we actually mean by well-being. Can I start with you, Valerie?
Okay, so one of the ways that well-being is looked at could be around the five ways to well-being, because it's about keeping active, keeping learning, keeping connected, taking notice, and giving. Keeping active is about the physical activity. Keeping connected, really tricky at the moment with the social distancing. So how do we manage that? And to keep learning, how do we change that sense of purpose? For some of us, we're still working, we're working in different ways, we're having to learn different ways. For other people, they're furloughed. And also maybe the speed of our life is changing slightly. So that taking notice maybe is coming into effect. And the other thing is about giving. And I think there are an awful lot, if you look at the call to arms of people volunteering, that volunteering rate seems to have gone up. I think that those things might be quite useful to start framing how we think about well-being.
Are those five areas, they're what people understand by well-being, are they?
They are one way of defining well-being. As I think you alluded to, there are lots of different ways. I think it's quite a neat way of defining it that more people can understand in a broader sense than some of the technical jargon that you get when we look at more academic literature to look at it. It is based on academic literature, but I think it's put in terminology that is probably easier for people to understand.
Thanks, Valerie. And Marie, your background in diet and the effect of dietary components on health. Well-being for you is perhaps one removed, or would you say it's central to what you do?
Absolutely central, really. And following on from what Valerie said, nutrition research in the past has been about keeping people mentally and physically well. But we've kind of really broadened out now. And when we look at the effectiveness of interventions that we test, we look at a life well lived or human well-being using a concept which has come out of Harvard School of Public Health called flourishing, which covers a lot of the concepts that Valerie has been talking about, that actually a life well lived is much more than being physically and mentally well. There's six components. There's happiness and life satisfaction. There's character and virtue. There's your life as meaning and purpose. You have close personal connectivity and relationships. And the last one, which is kind of an add-on, is that you need to be reasonably financially secure. But there's a cutoff for that, above which if you earn more, you're not necessarily happier or weller. So I think in research and in public health now, thankfully, we've got well beyond the notion that a life well lived is simply that we're physically or mentally well. It's much more all-encompassing than that.
Thank you, Henry. And Glenn, from your side, you are looking at the links between diet and health and the physiological adaptation to it. Can you say a bit more about that and how that affects well-being?
Yeah, I mean, I think it links into the general areas and the general framework that both Anne-Marie and Valerie had just mentioned, in that one of the, I think, contributing factors for many people to well-being is being physically active and the benefits, both physical and psychological benefits that we get from physical activity. And they come about because of how the body adapts. And obviously we need optimal nutrition to make sure that adaptation process actually happens and happens effectively. And I do think it's really important how these things might be influenced and might be changing during times like this, where we've got social isolation, we've got people working from home, people maybe either struggling to be as active as they usually are, or on the other hand, maybe doing a whole different type of activity that they're not used to in order to try and keep active. So I think the role of that and also our nutrition and diet in general and how that helps support that is really important and interesting for me.
And I think that is an interesting point, isn't it? That we are having to adapt, we are having to change, and there's a lot of challenge with that. But there is also the potential. We've heard a lot about the way people are, you know, dusting off their old bikes and getting out there and exercising when they have to, which is potentially a very positive thing that may well come out of this. Valerie, I know you've done work in the past on managing change. Can you say a bit about how we do manage those type of changes of circumstance?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, what we're having to go through at the moment. If we go back to the physical activity example, what I think is really quite interesting is the chief medical officer actually stood up there and probably for the first time she really said, you need to go out and you need to exercise. And it made it really important on the list of priorities of people to do was to go out and exercise. And as you said, people changed sometimes in what they were doing in order to go out. And what we did see in one of our bits of data is that it has gone up very slightly, physical activity, but it depends on who you're looking at. And I think this is the complexity of the whole thing, is what is part of my change and what part of my system. So I'm lucky to be able to work at home in a job where actually most of it can be done at home, apart from interacting with students. I've got 3 children, but they're older, which is totally different to somebody else who maybe has been furloughed or is trying to work with young children. And I think it's those complexities that make it really difficult to work out how to best go about some of these changes. And we know for a fact that certainly the data we're seeing is that the socioeconomically deprived areas are struggling even more. The change that people are experiencing is totally different. You know, I think it's that, how do we manage the different things? And I think it is a really challenging thing. Normally we'd expect in a working situation that we would be led by the people around us. We'd fit into those social norms of what other people are doing. But it's really hard when we're so disconnected. How do we do that? So I think it's really complicated. What we'd expect might be part of a system that we understood before, just a totally different system now.
True. It's interesting what you say about us taking cues from those around us, particularly in the work environment where we spend most of our waking life. And you say that there are virtual ways of doing it. Is there any sense of taking cues in our immediate environment? You know, we have this clapping for carers on a Thursday where there's this community spirit. Is there any evidence that we are taking our cues from alternative areas now that our work environment is all virtual?
I think people are taking quite a lot of cues from social media, for good and for worse, you know, and I think that's the challenge. The problem with that is there is a sense of overload of information. How do you manage that? If we're talking about well-being and being exposed to too much, not just the news, but all the other things that are going on. One of the bits of work that we did was about fear of missing out. And I know that people are struggling because they're now spending more time on social media. They're watching what everybody else is doing and wondering whether they should be doing some of those things as well. So I think it's taking cues from everybody else. I think we just have to be really careful about what those cues are. And I think as people's well-being alters over this period of time, what they're receptive to will change. So they may have been quite resilient to fake news before, but they're so desperate for answers to some of the things they've got queries about, that they're taking their answers from not necessarily the most robust sources, or getting involved in arguments with people about whether the government's doing the right thing about anything. So I think it is a real minefield because people have got maybe a bit more time. So if we can somehow invest in positive cues, so one of the things is around physical activity. How do we make it so it's easier to do that physical activity? In the workplace, you always get to say, get up, go to the water cooler. But maybe we can cue that so that maybe we can walk around with our Zoom call on our phone. It's trying to work out what those positive cues are.
And that's a really interesting point about having to be more resilient when we're almost cast adrift from everyday life. Yes, Anne-Marie, you wanted to
Following on from something that Valerie was saying, one of the lovely things about being at home and having a tiny bit more time is you can do free courses online. And there's this course online from Yale University called The Science of Happiness. And it's a fantastic course, really accessible course. And I was on week 3 of the course last night. They were talking about that very topic about cues and where we take our cues from as human beings, and that we always often pick quite unrealistic cues and judge ourselves versus a cue that's not at all appropriate to our lives and the dangers of that. And, you know, during lockdown, when we see a family doing incredibly well with homeschooling or creating the perfect meal in the kitchen, suddenly it can make us feel really inadequate because ours is never going to be as good as that. So I guess it's just to kind of make us aware as human beings how unrealistic we are when we line ourselves up against other people and the dangers of that, and actually bring it right back and just be grateful for what you've done today and what you've achieved within the realms of your possibilities.
That chimes in with something Jeremy Farrar, the director of the Wellcome Trust, tweeted the other day. Advice from the Canadian government about how to work remotely. The first one, and there were 5 or 6 points. The first one was, you are not working from home. You are at home during a crisis trying to work, which is a very different thing. But further down, it says, you'll be kind to yourself and not judge how you are coping based on how you see others coping.
Yeah.
And equally, you'll be kind to others and not judge how they are coping based on how you are coping.
That's right.
And I think that goes back to your point, Anne-Marie, that we set ourselves unrealistic targets as a result of what we see around us or the Instagram and Facebook world. Glenn, with your work in physical performance, whether it be elite athletes or everyday, do you have any recommendations around how to build in that exercise that Valerie was talking about?
I think it's an interesting point, but just before I say that, if I could just quickly go back to something that Valerie mentioned. I think it was a really interesting point. She said that on average, when you look at the data and the statistics, it seems like there's a bit of an increase in physical activity level, which is really great. But the thing that was really important for me was it depends on which groups and populations you look at. So there might be some people who are really struggling and maybe their activity has decreased a lot because of the current situation. And it does relate a bit to the sort of stuff that I look at with regards to physiological adaptations, because there is the opposite as well. There's the de-adaptation, if you like, or what we might refer to as detraining. And you can lose all of that benefit that you've gained much more quickly than it takes you to build it up. And even if people are meeting what the guidelines say for total amount of physical activity, there's still some risks and some dangers from having long periods of sedentary time. And as we're doing this, working at home or being at home during a crisis trying to work, I think there's probably a greater probability of having long periods of sedentary time. And what we mean by that is basically sitting and moving very little for extended periods of time. And that can be actually really negative for health. So even though on average we might be seeing an increase in physical activity, there's still going to be groups of people who are facing extra challenges. To come back to your question about what people can do, we hear the message a lot with how important physical activity is in general and in particular during these times. But as we've discussed, there can be challenges. So I guess relating to the sedentary time, even if people don't feel like they are able to be very active and go out and do something like running or cycling, if they can just break up their sedentary time throughout the day, try to move around a little bit more. And if that just means get off the sofa or get out of your chair, stand up and stroll around the room a little bit, then that's actually going to be beneficial and certainly more beneficial than not doing anything. And all of those little things like trying to stay connected, if you find that motivation is an issue, maybe you could set up something virtual. You could have an online conference call with a group of friends and maybe all exercise together. And I think another important message, of course, is that we're talking about physical activity and physical activity is so diverse. It can cover almost anything. We've talked a little bit about running and cycling, but gardening, cleaning up the shed or the garage or sorting out part of your house, anything is physical activity. So for me, a really important message is physical activity is yes, very, very valuable, but it comes in many, many shapes and sizes and all of those are beneficial.
And I think that's a key point. I love that phrase, anything is physical activity. A lot of the lockdown, I feel, is both a pro and a con. The pro of working at home, of thinking differently about how we do things, is allowing us to be perhaps more flexible in our routines. But there's a con to that. If we're too flexible and we don't have the routine, it doesn't give us that structure which helps our well-being. Another element that perhaps goes by the wayside when it comes to being at home is eating regularly, eating well. And it's very easy to graze, I think, because the kitchen's just next door to your office, essentially. Anne-Marie, can you say a bit more about diet during lockdown and what we do around that to maintain our well-being?
Yeah, what you eat, your nutrition affects your long-term health, but of course it also affects how you feel on a day-to-day basis. And a lack of structure or a new routine, and you put on top of that stress. You know, these are stressful times for people. And that can really play havoc with your nutrition and your food intake. This kind of lack of planning and lack of structure can lead to a lot of what I would call mindless overeating, where you kind of find yourself wandering towards the kitchen or wandering towards the fridge or wandering towards the biscuit tin, kind of without even realizing it. And oftentimes we're not even hungry. It's because we're feeling thirsty, perhaps. Just the fact we're dehydrated can often make us feel hungry. So the first thing is when you find yourself wandering towards the kitchen, just bring yourself back and try and think, am I actually hungry or am I perhaps a little dehydrated? And often stress, you know, stress is a real physiological response. The body produces more cortisol and other stress hormones. Play havoc with our appetite and satiety. They cause us to overeat, and they often cause us to overeat the wrong kinds of foods, high fat and high sugar foods.
The common theme running through a lot of this is almost adjusting our thinking, making us perhaps more conscious of whether we are actually hungry, making us more conscious about doing exercise or including different forms of exercise in what we do. Valerie, in your work, I know you've worked with Essex County Council in terms of change management. What is your recommendation about how that is implemented, whether it be in terms of mental processes or actually doing specific things to ensure that change is successful?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because I think, as we said, it's continual flux. What we thought was the routine last week is not what it is in the week following that. We're kind of creatures of habit, quite a lot of us. If our habits are generally good, we can take those on and keep going with some of those things. But when that routine changes or those habits change, it makes it very difficult to then find the right way again. And when you came back to the cues, you know, making those positive, that we hide the biscuit tin or whatever, or we make sure we have a routine, that we don't just wander through to the kitchen. Mine is more checking Facebook than going to eat food, but that doesn't help my stress levels. So it's trying to work out what's the right thing to do in that moment that you need to maybe have a break. And obviously Glenn's suggestion would be to get up and walk around. And it might be that we can go back to those five ways to well-being, and actually you can start taking notice and just taking time. Because I think from the work that I've been doing with some of the people from the University of Essex, we've been exploring me time. You know, they're working in environments where either their children are at home or they've got dependents or they're having to look after people remotely, and they're not finding that ability just really for their own self. And maybe that taking notice, going back to one of those well-being points, is just allowing ourselves not to check our phone, not to go to the biscuit cupboard, but just to look at the world around us and almost feel reconnected and blessed that we've got the things that we have around us.
we're in such uncharted territories in having this national, this global lockdown. Are there any situations which even remotely resemble what we're going through that we can learn from?
I mean, I think that throughout everybody's lives, there are always transition points, aren't there? Going back to Anne-Marie's cortisol and how that changes our ability to cope, both in terms of what we do and the nutrition that we take on board. So I think if we can look at some of those things, it might help us to unlock some ways of doing that. But I think Anne-Marie might have some interesting things to say on this point as well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess when you look at times of acute disaster throughout the world, you know, when there's hurricanes that wipe out whole cities, or when there's areas of the world that are undergoing significant war, you know, in war zones and so forth, when people are kind of exposed to a dramatic change to their life, would probably be the closest reference point. But I guess it comes back to this kind of circle of influence. Your circle of influence, just look at what you can influence yourself and positively change. And then there's a circle of concern, which is all the things that are going on around you that you can worry about, but you can't really change very much, or you can't do very much about. So I suppose, as you know, when it comes to things like well-being during this crisis, things like our behaviors, how much we exercise, how much we stay socially connected, how we're kind of really mindful and plan and are cognizant of what we're eating throughout the day, that is within our circle of influence. That is something we can do something about. So I think it's just, as human beings, to, rather than our head exploding with the enormity of it all, to bring it back to our circle of influence.
I think that's a really useful way of looking at it, the circle of influence, and trying to control the things we can and be more sanguine about the things we can't.
I mean, I have to say, it's good in theory. It's a little bit more it's a little bit more difficult to practice, but I guess at least if we try, we might kind of nudge ourselves a bit towards focusing more on what we can do something about. You know, how much we reach out to people, planning what you eat throughout the day, having a little bit of a think of what do I have on today, what physical activity can I fit in. You know, those are things we can influence, and they might as well take our minds off the things that we can't influence.
So I guess it's coming back to that routine, isn't it?
Yeah.
Not to be rigid about it, because we do flexible, but there needs to be certain things that are non-negotiable in that routine, I guess. But I think it's trying to make sure that you, as you say, you control what you can control. And I think the other thing is there anything that you can get rid of, sort out both physically and mentally during this time as well? Is this a time where you can give yourself that space to physically remove some stuff? We probably all did that quite well at the beginning. But is there some mental stuff that we can shift? People that maybe we don't talk to lots, that we haven't made connections with during this time, and maybe we don't need to keep them firmly in our group of friends. We can maybe have other groups of people that are positive relationships rather than the negative relationships. So it's going back to that social connection, making those as positive as possible.
I think that's a crucial point to bear in mind. Having a structure but not adhering too rigidly to it, so it becomes a burden rather than a positive.
The thing about a routine, I think, is really, really useful and really valuable. It might be more tricky, or I guess it might take more psychological effort for people who are maybe facing this alone. If you're at home and you have a family and you have other things that you need to get up for, to sort the kids for homeschooling and all of that sort of stuff, that's already a bit of a heads up on the structure and the routine. I guess people who might be more at risk of struggling with that would be the people who live alone. And that could go across the whole range of society, from, you know, sort of young professional people all the way up to more elderly individuals. But it could be more difficult for them. So I think, you know, reaching out and making social connections. And I think one of the things that people are doing a lot of is kind of non-social connections, you know, Zoom meetings galore for people through work. But if they can maybe try to make time to actually do that socially as well, I think could be really valuable for those people.
I want to finish by just touching briefly on two projects I'm aware of that are going on at both UEA and Essex in terms of looking at the long-term effect of the lockdown on health and well-being. Anne-Marie, I know you're involved in one led by Caitlin Notley in the Norwich Medical School. Could you tell me a bit more about it?
So we started this. I mean, the initial project has been funded by the university itself, but we've actually put in a grant application now as well to the NIHR to increase the scope of what we're doing. But it's basically a project where we've recruited so far 1,100 people, and we are virtually tracking their behavior each day for 3 months. So folks fill out a baseline questionnaire where we capture a lot of information about their home situation, their income, their household income, their social economic information, their demographic and so forth. And then we follow that up each day. They get a text message and it asks them to note down information on their nutrition, their drinking habits, their sleep habits, their physical activity, their medication use, their drug use, their smoking over the previous 24 hours. And there's about 30 questions we ask people each day. It takes a couple of minutes, maybe 5 minutes for 3 months. And we're about 5 weeks in. And we think that'll be a really useful data resource, actually, just to show how the current environmental situation and social lockdown is influencing people's behavior, and particularly to try and identify if there's really vulnerable groups that we really need to target with support for future public health policy and future public health interventions.
I can imagine that being really useful in terms of almost getting real-time data on the way trends change and people's behaviours change over time. Valerie, can you say a bit about the Essex tracker study?
Yeah, so ours is called The State of Life. We're looking at slightly different things to Anne-Marie. So it comes out of the work that I do with Essex County Council, and it's run by Reason Digital and Jump, who are our partners on our Essex County Council Consortium for the evaluation team. We're trying to do it probably every other week, and we're looking around physical activity, why the people are doing physical activity, around capability, opportunity, and motivation. We're looking about various other questions around trust, community spirit, how their work-life balance has changed. So what we've done is we've taken questions from questionnaires that are already out there. So hopefully it means that we can go back and see how the data's changed from before. So obviously trying to have a baseline for this is quite tricky. And so we're exploring that. So the things that we're looking at is deprivation and looking to see what's going on with there. We can see that they've got higher levels of inactivity. Families though, and I think it comes back to Glenn's point, they seem to be doing better on the activity stakes than they were before. They seem to be lower in activity, and they also seem to be more motivated. I think actually coming back, it supports what Glenn was saying about, you know, actually having to do these things, get the children outside the houses. And I think even in some of the areas where they don't have gardens, they're, you know, trying to get them away from the home. Older people, unfortunately, this has declined. Not really surprising. Our older population tends to be reasonably active and also seem to volunteer more. Obviously, they can't at the moment. So going back to that sense of purpose for them, that seems to be declining. And it does seem to be that mental health is declining, but well-being overall is holding up so far. We've done two lots of data. We've got 920 in our first rollout, and then we're tracking them over time. And people can enter that study at any time. And the aim that we're hoping for is that we can actually make a difference. What is it that we can put in place to try and help? So we know that, for example, some of the stuff that's coming out, the government's talking about changing cycle and pedestrian access. How can we look at that? So we're really hoping that it makes a difference rather than just some data that's really interesting for us academics. How does it make a difference in the real world?
As well as research that's being triggered by the current lockdown, I know that academics are struggling to continue research which started beforehand, particularly where there's participants that need to come into the universities and be monitored. Glenn, can you say a bit about how that is being managed at Kent?
There's one particular area of research that we do a lot of in my school at the University of Kent, and that is understanding and monitoring the benefits of exercise in various clinical populations. And one study in particular we've been working on since 2016, and this is a study looking into the beneficial effects of regular exercise in people with Parkinson's. And we've actually been engaged with a local community group where we help them to deliver a weekly exercise class for people with Parkinson's, and we've got 25 people with Parkinson's involved in that, and they've been coming since around about 2016. So this has been going on for quite a long time, and we have seen lots of beneficial effects from that, and we've been monitoring this in various ways. We've been looking at physical fitness and physiological measures, which are relevant to things like activities of daily living, and which are really important. We've been looking at psychological markers, quality of life indices, and we've also been conducting regular focus groups and conducting more qualitative information. We've seen beneficial effects in all of these areas, and also the positive feedback that we get from the group, whereby they really value this. And I don't think it's just a physical effect. I think it's a social interaction, being part of a group. So I think there's lots of reasons why this is beneficial. And obviously with social distancing and the lockdown, we weren't able to continue that in its original format. And I guess our biggest worry there was that really beneficial activity that these individuals were getting was going to be lost. So what we actually have done is switched it to online, and we're still getting pretty much the same attendance. So we still essentially run the class once a week for them, and all of the participants join. They do it in their own home. They all join via Zoom, and they are basically still doing this physical exercise. So what we hope is that they will continue to get the benefit. And actually, maybe it's helping, you know, adding a certain amount of routine. They can see the other people in the group. They can have a chat. And some of them actually connect to the Zoom call before the class starts and just have a get together and a chat with each other. It's not quite the same. And obviously, we can't see them in person. We used to reassess them on a number of these markers every 3 months or so. I think it will be interesting, of course, from a research perspective, to see if we've maintained that same level of benefit from this alternative mode of delivery. But for me, the most important thing is more about the benefit to these people and the kind of social and community benefit of allowing this activity to continue rather than having to shut it down.
And I think that's a good point to end on, the need to adapt and change the way we work, but be aware of, as Anne-Marie described it, the circle of influence, what we can change, and be aware of the circle of concern and almost park it to one side and not get caught up in that. But also to maintain that framework that gives some sense of structure to what we do, but not be too slavish to it, to be able to adapt and flex it according to what we need, and to keep, above all, that mental health at the top of what our daily agenda is. Thank you all for taking part in it. Thanks, Anne-Marie Minahane. Thanks, Valerie Gladwell. And thanks, Glenn Davison, for taking part today. And thanks to others who were involved in the podcast, including Jeff Harvey and Chris Martin, who provided the music. And thanks to all of you out there listening. I hope you can join me next time when we're going to move beyond coronavirus to look at some of the events that were affected by it in the universities of the Eastern Arc.